I have a couple of announcements. First of all, I'm Janice Calabresi. I'm the Lawyers Division Director. And if any of you have any problems with rooms or registration, banquet, conference, anything at all, please find me or find one of the other Federal Society assistants. We're all very easily identified by the red ribbons. There are several people sitting right outside that can help you with any problems that come up. I think there were three coats left downstairs, and if those coats had been moved upstairs to the registration area, so if the owners of those coats are looking for them afterwards, check at the registration table. We will have a coat room tonight. We didn't think it would be this cold in Louisiana, so we didn't plan for one this afternoon. And with that, I would like to turn it over to former Attorney General Edwin Meese III, an old-time friend of the Federalist Society who really needs no introduction to this group.
Thank you very much, Janice. It's a pleasure for me to have the opportunity to serve as moderator of this opening panel this afternoon. Professor Weinstein, speaking earlier, when he was talking about the challenges to the rule of law, pointed out that there was an absence of entrepreneurial structures, among other things. I want to assure you that among lawyers, however, at least in the United States, there is certainly an entrepreneurial spirit that is universal. It was illustrated just today, this noon, as we were walking back from lunch, and some of you may have seen a block away an automobile that had been deserted after having crashed into a traffic sign pole there. My colleague and friend Joe Schmitz was walking with me, and he looked inside to make sure no one was trapped under the seat, and there on the seat of the automobile was a lawyer's business card, pointing out that indeed the entrepreneurial spirit is universal. Today our topic is the property rights and the new legal order. I think it's particularly appropriate that we consider property rights at the start of our examination and discussions of the development of new legal structures and principles that are being developed for the emerging democracies of Eastern and Central Europe. Because the concept of property and the rights pertaining to it was fundamental to those who drafted our Constitution in the United States and who developed the legal system that flowed from it. In 1787, there was no question in the minds of our founders that the right to acquire, hold, and dispose of property was a critical component of individual liberty. That fact was a vital premise of the Constitution itself. So vital that it didn't need to be explicitly set forth, although references to it and applications of it are found in the provisions of the Constitution itself, as well as in the Bill of Rights. Today, the concept of property has the same importance as it did over 200 years ago, but now on a global scale. Dave McIntosh told you, and Dick Thornburgh himself mentioned how he, as Attorney General, had traveled to the Soviet Union to talk about individual rights, freedom of contract, and property rights under the overall theme of the rule of law in democratic societies. Indeed, in his very well-chosen remarks, he emphasized this subject several times about the importance of the sanctity of contracts and respect for property rights as essential elements of a system that embodies the rule of law. You heard him say with a great deal of emphasis that property rights are the key to the revival of the economies of Eastern and Central Europe and for the protection of individual freedom. The question before this conference today, as we start to explore the development of new legal orders, is how do you establish a legal system that encompasses this concern for property rights, where there are minimal foundations for these concepts, or perhaps none at all? Well, to discuss this question and to provide answers, we have four distinguished speakers. Their biographies, which are extensive, are listed in the booklet in your packets, and so I am not going to read them in detail, but refer you to them. But I will comment briefly upon each one as they start to speak. Each speaker will talk for about 10 minutes. As a matter of fact, they'll talk for no longer than 10 minutes. And at the end of that 40-minute presentations, we will open it up to questions from the audience as well as a brief discussion among the speakers themselves. Our first speaker will be Mr. Pavel Bratinka, who is a member of the Parliament of the Czech and Slovak Federative Republic, who brings a particular distinction to this group, and that is that for many years he participated in and contributed to underground academic activities and underground academic journals. I'm sure conservatives who have been in law school over the past two decades can appreciate and sympathize with that. I told him that I suspected the reason, that at least an American would suspect that the reason he contributed to an underground journal was so that it would be read. Mr. Bratinka has another distinction, and that is his background and training was in physics, and he has since adapted his considerable talents not only to matters such as public policy, political science, and now the rule of law, but also to the legislative devices to bring the concepts we're discussing into being. It's my great privilege to introduce our visitor and guest, Mr. Bratinka.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is indeed a great honor for me to be able to address such distinguished people like you. Property rights are indeed, or should indeed, form an integral part of a legal system of any country which deserves to be called free country. In this respect, the situation in Czechoslovakia was extremely bad. The Soviets excepting, the Czechoslovak communists had been the most fanatical enemies of the private ownership in the whole Eastern Europe. They had carried out several waves of ever more sweeping nationalizations, the last one in 1959, by which nationalizations they had stolen almost every piece of property in private hands. They hadn't even tolerated private ice cream stands. This was a big difference with neighboring countries. The methods of nationalizations included outright confiscation and many other methods which forced people to give up their property voluntarily, but in question marks, like punitive taxation, supply discrimination, rent control combined with strict enforcement of maintenance duties and many others, including physical force. By early 60s, only 2% of land was privately owned, and a tiny portion of apartment houses remained in private hands. A person could have legally owned only one house of up to 120 square meters and one so-called object for recreation or recuperation of his capability to work for the government. Any house of more than 120 square meters was declared an apartment house, and the owner was obliged to rent it to tenants. In addition, people's savings, shares, bonds, life policies, etc. were wiped out by the 1953 currency reform. And finally, relentless propaganda and indoctrination were denigrating the private ownership as something pernicious and socially destructive. The communists recognized only so-called personal ownership, or rather personal belongings, and even cooperative type of ownership, which they preserved in the area of agriculture, where farmers technically remained the owners of the land which was collectivized. Even this type of ownership was held under constant suspicion and under vigilant supervision, lest it should become the private ownership in disguise. Although the ideological fanatism certainly played a role in the nationalization drive, there has always been one rational and finally decisive motive behind it. When state becomes a sole employer, then it wields such a power over human life that all other classical tools of oppression are almost unnecessary. There are millions of witnesses of this truth in my country. Really, right-wing dictatorships were thus no match to communist ones in thoroughness of social control. But ultimately, the communists destroyed the property rights as such, because when everything was owned by everybody, there was practically no legal basis or no possible definition how to define or from what to derive the rights of management or particular ministry to administer the property or the enterprises under its control. Thanks God, this nightmare passed away, and we are now on a way back to normality. Last June, the people of Czechoslovakia voted overwhelmingly in favor of the notion of the private property as a rule and the state property as an exception. I feel a pride at having been able to inform you that Czechoslovakia is the only country from the formerly communist ones which decided not only to privatize the state property, but also to redress past injustices and robberies. Former owners or their heirs are going to be compensated either by physical restitution of the objects they owned or by what we call gilt-edged means, money or stock or various vouchers which will give them the property rights. We are of course aware that 100% restitution or compensation is beyond the capacity of our impoverished country. Nevertheless, we think that the idea of the inviolability of private property wouldn't take sufficient roots without some solemn bow to the goddess of justice. So we have adopted one law called the restitution law, which will give back immediately the small pieces of property like pubs, hotels, small workshops, etc. And we are in the process of preparing so-called big restitution law, which will give back all other property, provided it is feasible and objects exist or there are not complications which will prevent it. Then the compensation will be financial. We have also adopted a law which empowers the state to sell small businesses at auctions, meaning the businesses which are really in the property of state, which were not confiscated but which were built by the state. Everybody who was a Czechoslovak citizen by the day of the communist takeover, that is 25th February 1948, will be eligible. Foreigners will be eligible in the second round auctions. That means things which are not going to be sold at the first round will be sold at the second round, and the foreigners can come and buy them. The biggest problem will be the privatization of the medium and large enterprises, since there is a very little capital in private hands. Total savings in my country represent about 2/3 of 1 year GNP. And even more importantly, nobody knows the market prices of objects to be sold. There is no market. Therefore, we shall have to use untested method of vouchers, when each citizen of Czechoslovakia will receive one voucher for some very small fee, with which he or she will be able to purchase shares issued by state enterprises turned into joint stock companies. Since everybody will have a right to opt for any company he thinks promising, the final outcome of this giant auction will be some rough would-be market pricing. This pricing will provide important guide for those who would like to buy additional issue of shares which will bear nominal value in money terms, and there we think even foreign company or foreign investors will be allowed to opt or to make their bids. What should interest us most here is that every citizen of my country will get a stake in private ownership, an incentive to learn more about enterprising and markets, and I hope a strong disincentive to the bane of any sound economy, which is called envy. The hottest issues today are the following. First, how far should the physical restitution go? That is a clash between the technocratic and spiritual free marketeers. For technocratic free marketeers, the restitution of property is just a necessary complication. It only slows down the process of privatization. But for those who think in market societies, something much more important and spiritual, this is a must we have to pass through. The second problem is how to prevent monopolies from using their dominance and raising their prices without infringing upon market mechanism. That means we are now employing some price control mechanism, which is, of course, an intervention in your own property rights. But given the situation that most of the industry still remains in the hands of the completely irresponsible bureaucrats, we have to, the government must supply or play the role of an invisible hand. And the third problem is how to stave off attempts to impose by law so-called decision sharing of employees in companies' management. This pernicious idea is peddled by trade unions, which seem not knowing what they are doing. Generally speaking, the devils of socialism and lawlessness were banished from my country, but the process of creating free society based upon the rule of law will be a lengthy one, and we need all the help available. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pretenka, for your very interesting message and also for setting a great example by staying within the time limit. I'm about to introduce a speaker who can compress more words into the amount of time than almost anyone I know. Professor Richard Epstein is well known, obviously, to those of you who have attended previous Federalist Society activities. He is one of the premier experts in the country on law and economics, particularly on regulation of industry and on matters such as we're discussing today. It's a great privilege to bring him back to a Federalist Society program. Professor Epstein.
I had originally thought that I would talk about some nice points of monetary economics, but after listening to Mr. Thornburg and Mr. Pretenkin, I wrote a different speech, which I will now give to you today. And the title of this speech essentially, Do As We Say, Not As We Do. It seems to me that what has happened in the United States here, and it's Mr. Thornburg, Mr. Meese, is we have a great deal of nostalgia. That is, what we do when we talk about American constitutionalism, we constantly invoke that fellow up there, James Madison. We talk about the sanctity of property, and we talk about the sanctity of contract. And I agree with those positions, and I think I've defended them as forcefully and as fearfully as anybody else could possibly do. And I think the great tragedy is that they are not followed in the United States today. They are systematically disregarded by Republicans and Democrats alike. What we ought to do, therefore, and my advice to Mr. Pretenkin, is to listen to our rhetoric, but don't take our advice on any concrete affairs. You will mess it up beyond all recognition. Let me see if I could be a little bit more pointed. There was a supreme irony in the Attorney General's speech when he noted that Mr. Segan had been asked to write the Constitution for Bulgaria. I want you all to recall that back in 1987 or so, Mr. Segan could not get an appointment to the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, largely because he had written a book called Economic Liberties in the Constitution, which had generally advocated in a rather temperate and moderate form, far less rigorous and systematic than I would advocate, a protection of economic and contract rights. The very thing which disqualified him from public office in the United States is the thing which ought to commend him to everybody in Bulgaria and Eastern Europe as an expert on American constitutionalism. Let me then go further and try to talk about this as a substantive matter. The Attorney General referred to the fact that we believed in the rule of law. And it seems to me that we have to be extraordinarily careful when we talk about the rule of law to distinguish between it as a procedural device on the one hand and a substantive device on the other. Everybody believes in the rule of law in the first question. If you are in favor of the minimum wage or in favor of the anti-discrimination laws, if you're in favor of some of the various other restrictions on labor and so forth, you believe in the rule of law, but you know exactly what the content of that rule of law ought to be. And so the Attorney General was quite correct when he immediately said that it's not a procedural system, it's in fact a system which believes in private property and freedom of contract, and it's an effort to try and stabilize the way in which private relationships ought to be formed. You would think, however, that there was some rule of law in the United States having heard of that particular speech. But since 1937, all the things that were advocated most dearly have in fact been expressly repudiated under the Constitution that's been interpreted. Mr. Brtinkin was smart enough to remind us of the rent control problem and to indicate the enormous amounts of dislocations that are associated with the system of rent control. The United States Supreme Court in 1922 and 1943 again and again sustained the constitutionality of rent control statutes, which are far more mindless and far more perverse and far more pernicious than any which he has managed to describe. And yet we will tell them how it is that they ought to organize the rule of law. Then we go back and we start to talk about the problems of labor relations. And of course, what he said made eminent good sense is that you cannot have a system of sensible co-determination to keep markets operative. You must make sure that to the extent that there are labor unions, that they're only consensual. But in the United States, we're smarter. In 1937, we sustained the constitutionality of the National Labor Relations Act, the key feature of which was to insist upon mandatory collective bargaining in ways that enhance the power of monopoly labor on the one hand and destroy the ability of firms to operate within competitive markets. And if you want to go down the list, it's a very impressive list of what we have been able to achieve under the rule of law. My paper sort of ran out of space as I started to list the kinds of restriction on freedom of contract that are routinely accepted today. Well, back early on, we had the workmen's compensation laws. Nothing wrong with the workmen's compensation system. It's voluntary, but the moment it becomes state-imposed, it's just another interference with freedom of contract. But we go better than that. In addition, we have OSHA, which is an abomination and a complicated system. And of course, it's been rigorously enforced by Democratic and Republican administrations alike. We have minimum wage laws under the Fair Wage Standard Laws. Fair Labor Standards Act, and those were enforced and raised under a Republican administration. Then it turns out that we have the anti-discrimination laws, which will hurt everybody in the long and the short run. And in the present administration, we take the worst possible form of those statutes, the handicap discrimination law, the Americans with Disabilities Act, and pass that with the support of a Republican administration. What I want to say is really very simple. If the people in Eastern Europe are to follow our advice, and were to institute in their countries the legal regimes that we have in place in our countries today, given their small capital bases, they will essentially guarantee their own economic destruction. The only thing that they have to do is to listen to our rhetoric, to make sure that when we talk about freedom of contract and the sanctity of property, they do what we say. If they do what we do, since they start from such a lower base, they will find themselves back in the same kind of turmoil from which they are trying so desperately to escape. The only reason why America will survive at least another generation is that we have a sufficiently large accumulation of capital and labor that the misguided policies that we follow in this country will take enough time before they destroy and erode what little good that we have been able to do. We simply have lost in this country the sense of technique. We don't understand the importance of private autonomy. We don't know in areas of state regulation or federal regulation what you're supposed to do. We pass incredibly complicated tax codes with 26 different forms of interest with varying rules of deductions. We have an environmental code which is so numbing in its complexity and perverse in its consequences that we will probably create more pollution at higher price than anything imaginable. So what I say again is there are institutional economists who could tell you about small things, but when the grand delegations start going across from American law professors, I think you ought to listen to them, Mr. Brtinkin, with enormous politeness and then forget everything that they say and open up your copy of Federalist 10 and you'll be way ahead of the game. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Epstein. I couldn't help but think as you were talking, and particularly as you concluded, that the Federal Republic of Germany did exactly that in 1948. They listened to the economists that were sent over by the American State Department, disregarded their advice, and perfected a very excellent economy in Germany. So your advice is certainly well taken. Our next speaker is a gentleman with whom I had the privilege of debating at Oxford in England earlier this year, And the topic there was, we were debating, by the way, together on the same side against a member of the East German Parliament and a deputy foreign minister from the Soviet Union. The topic was resolved, or whether the United States system or socialism was likely to be the wave of the future in the 1990s. The vote, fortunately, went in favor of the American side in Oxford, but the historical vote, which we've seen take place since that time, has even gone more particularly in favor of this system. It's a pleasure to bring to the podium now another very strong supporter of the Federalist Society and one who has been a great help both during his service in the executive branch of the government and now as a judge of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals to the cause of property rights, freedom, and generally to the rule of law, Professor Alex Kaczynski.
Thank you, Mr. Attorney General. I feel I've been elevated to the rank of professor, but shortly after the visit to Oxford, Attorney General Meese went back to Washington, I think, and I went to Bucharest. I wanted to see with my own eyes what things looked like shortly after the revolution. And I hadn't been back in 17 years or some such amount of time, and I was surprised by how little actually had changed in that time. In my 10 minutes allotted to me, I want to talk a little bit about the problems of transition. I was amazed and surprised and pleased to hear from our first speaker about the developments in Czechoslovakia. It is a system that, if they keep going in that direction, will surely outpace us in not a very long time. The prognosis isn't quite as good. Elsewhere is the Eastern Bloc, and I know mostly about Romania, but I believe some of the same problems exist elsewhere, and perhaps even Czechoslovakia will run into them. I hope they can overcome them. The problem is that unfortunately what we do rather than what we say is based upon a certain philosophy, which is not constrained to the United States. It exists elsewhere as well, and it exists particularly in the minds of people who have lived under communism for 40 years, 70 years, and whatnot. And it's a very, very difficult problem, difficult political problem, difficult economic problem, how you get from here to there. Everybody thinks, believes, says that property rights are the way to go, that capitalism is a way of the future. But how do you move from capitalism, or from communism, or a system owned entirely by the government to a system where private property and private ownership is the principal, perhaps the only means of economic organization? The way I would phrase a problem for Romania, anyway, is how do you get 23 million people to take their hands out of each other's pockets all at the same time? It's true that for better or for worse, 23 million people in Romania, whom I know most about, they have lived under the system for better or for worse for the last 40 years. And everyone has a small or large stake in the system. They have a job in a factory, may not be a particularly well-paying job, but it gives them life security. It gives them a pension. They also have their own particular channels to the black market. They have the butcher who will sell them meat on the counter. They have friends in the West who will occasionally send them jeans or cigarettes or whatnot. And they have established, eked out a way of life that is sometimes very difficult to let go of. And it's really a question of the mind. It is a question of how do you suddenly, after having lived in a system that where the economy is state controlled, how do you suddenly change to a system where you believe that if market actors are individually acting according to their own impulses, that you will get as good a result or a better one? And let me give you an example. One of the most impressive figures I met while I was in Romania was an economist by the name of Dan Dayanu. He just finished spending some time at Harvard at the Kennedy School, and I had a talk with him about economics of farming. And I said, "Look, why don't you just give it all away? You know, pick a day in the year, and whoever happens to be standing on the piece of land, just give it to them. Don't sell it, don't try to auction it off, just give it to them and let them then do whatever they want with it." And he was intrigued by the idea, but he said, "You know, Alex, we had a study 4 years ago, and the study by the government was that Romania needs 18 million metric tons of wheat in order to survive. How do we know that all these farmers acting individually will come up with exactly 18 million metric tons? They might come up with too much or too little." We started talking about trade and so on. He says, "Yes, I mean, but that's a very substantial risk for us to take. We might have a famine. This was one of the most educated, obviously somebody who had studied Western economics, obviously who knew, understood what a free economic system worked like, and still he had that gut reaction. That reaction is multiplied 80 million times by every little individual in a factory who's saying, "Gee, you know, I have a job. It may be in a factory that doesn't produce very much. It may not be a particularly satisfying job. It may be in a as part of an economy that doesn't produce very much, but at least it is my foothold. It is a thing I'd have to give up and face the reality of the market." And they have never seen anybody succeed. They have never seen a neighbor make it big by investing in McDonald's or in opening a new business and really succeed in a grand way. I mean, we have a very great advantage. We really believe that one can make it in the market. Some of us do, others don't, but that, you know, we believe it is possibly done. They have no such role models. Now, the problem is complicated by the fact that it is a government who, after all, we know has done such a poor job up to now, that has to make a lot of these decisions. Again, I take my hat off to the Czech government for having made truly enlightened decisions. Let me tell you the experience of the Budapest Stock Exchange, which was related to me by the head of the exchange last summer. It was thought they would go ahead and privatize some of the business, and what they would do is they would sell stock. And it was thought what we good way of doing it is they would underprice the first series of issues of stock, and that way people would buy it and would quickly make a profit. The stock would rise, and then everybody else would see how well they'd done, and they get suckered in. And the next issue they could sell low. This was a nice, good kind of capitalist instinct. Well, everything went according to plan, and they did sell the stock, and they did sell it low, and it quickly went up, and there was a big uproar in Parliament. "They're giving away our property. They're giving it away for nothing." And the consequence was that they couldn't issue any more stock, so they wound up having taken the loss on the first issue, and then the political system got in the way of going in and cashing in on the benefits they had gotten by selling low. Finally, let me talk about the almost intractable problem of competing property rights. We talk about property, but as most of us here are lawyers, we understand property in this country has come to be defined to include a lot of things. And property sometimes means a right to your job. Sometimes it means a right to your pension. Sometimes it means a right to property or to a certain position. You have a country where you have, like Romania, where you have very seriously competing property rights. We have, of course, the original landowners, the people who owned the farms and the factories and the stores 10 years ago or 20 years ago or 40 years ago, in the case of the Soviet Union, 70 years ago. And there is a genuine need to recognize their interest in this property. But there are intervening property rights as well, at least as far as property rights as we would define them. There are vested pension rights. There are in various government enterprises, there are rights that workers have to particular positions, either by law or by tradition, jobs that cannot be taken away from them. And you wind up being put in a very difficult practical situation where you have to, if you follow one principle of property, give away the factory to its prior owners. Following the other principle of property, you have to pay off the people who have been relying on the property in the meantime and have developed vested property rights in between. It is the transitional problems, what will happen over the next 10 or 20 years and how these problems are handled and by what principles will really determine the success or failure moving to a capitalist system in some of these countries. I am greatly heartened by the way things are going in Czechoslovakia. I think things are going to go much slower and a good bit more uncertainty in some of the other countries. I think that conferences like this, where we can offer ideas and certainly some help that we can offer as United States citizens and budding capitalists are certainly welcome. But one thing I want to make sure that we do not do, the thing I kept hearing when I was in Romania is, boy, if we only got America to underwrite us for the next 20 years. If we only got them to kind of help us, you know, so that way people will not be out of work, and then that way we will underwrite the transitional process. The lesson that has to be learned is that transitions are hard. There is no easy way. There is no free lunch. There is no cheap way out of this dilemma. And that in order for an economic system to work, it has to hurt. It has to bite. It is unfortunate. It is sad. Insofar as we can help by sending out dollars on our in forms of investment, that's certainly a positive thing to be done. But we should not yield to the siren call of sending over gifts.
Thank you very much, Alex, for your frank appraisal. Our final speaker of our quartet here is Professor Andrzej Rapaczynski of Columbia Law School, who teaches, among other things, constitutional law and property at that law school, and has also in his past taught philosophy, which is probably a good combination for what he has been doing recently, which has been serving as an expert on constitutional issues in Warsaw, Poland, and helping in the drafting of constitutional matters there. It's a great privilege to bring him now to wind up our initial speeches and to talk about his experiences and his recommendations here. Professor?
I think it's suicidal for a speaker to take on George Kaczynski, but I want to begin by doing this. Namely, it seems to me that the last thing he said about not helping the countries of Eastern Europe by outright giveaways of one sort or another, I think is a very mistaken idea. Part of the reason why the countries of Eastern Europe are in such desperate shape is that they have their governments, or the governments imposed on them in the past 40 years, and in particular in the past 20 years or so, have borrowed enormous dictatorships in the future. To think that a country like Poland can pay $40 billion, which is mostly accumulated interest on loans that shouldn't have been made, is insane. These loans will not be paid. The question is whether they will be forgiven in some intelligent fashion, or whether they will bring down the economy of the whole region and the budding democracy in the whole region as well. And the one case of true economic miracle, Western Europe after World War II, did not develop because the United States said, you have to learn the hard lesson, the transition from a war and destruction to a market economy and reconstruction is something very painful. So let's impose some, let's maybe ask you to pay off all your debts and all the war reparations that you owe us and so on. No, this the Western European powers had done to Germany after the First World War, and the result was rather tragic. On the contrary, an unprecedented help was extended to Western Europe and to Germany in particular. And that was what allowed the West German economic miracle, not just intelligent capitalist policies. And unless something like that is done with respect to Eastern Europe, I don't think there is very much hope. Now, I'm sorry for this introduction, which is really not part of what I was intended to say. I intended to say a few words about the problems of privatization. One thing that has to be understood about privatization in Eastern Europe, that it is a very different phenomenon from what passes under that name in Western Europe and some other parts of the world. Britain had privatized a few companies over the years. It was touted as a great achievement. A rather small fraction of the economy has been transferred from state to private hands with great state subsidies in the process to make the companies attractive. And all of this was done within the framework of an existing market economy where you could put a price on enterprises. You could find underwriters for it. You could find people with a lot of capital who could buy it. And you did not face any serious political problems. In fact, it was quite privatization turned out to have been quite popular. Now, privatization in Poland and in other Eastern European countries is something quite different. It is not a transfer of ownership from the state to the private hands. It is the creation of property rights, or of property, of the institution of property as we understand it in the first place. And it is the creation of the infrastructure of a market capitalist system in the first place. So it's a qualitatively different process. When I say that it is a creation of property as such, rather than a transfer of ownership from one hand to the other, I have the following thing in mind. There are two ways in which you can deal with the problem of what the economists call the commons. When you have a piece of land that nobody owns, there are certain bads that are going to be overproduced and certain goods that are going to be underproduced. If you cannot reap what you sow, you are not going to put a lot of work in that soil. On the other hand, if you can take something from it and not pay the full cost of it, then you will take more than you usually than you otherwise would. And there are two ways of dealing with this problem. One way is to have a government that administers everything and regulates everything and assigns obligations and to people and then rewards them for it. So one way is to administer socially available resources. The other is not to rely on powers of the government, but rather to give people specific entitlements to various resources and rely on the fact that when they use it in their best interest, in an uncoordinated way, somehow the good of everybody is going to be served in the best way. Now, all economies, in fact, regulate somewhat, they regulate much more than Professor Epstein would like, and I'm sure much more than most of us would like in this room. But still, the case of Eastern Europe and Soviet Union until recently has been quite unique. Because except for the agricultural sector in Poland, the whole country, all of resources were practically administered. And people, businessmen, didn't exist. State functionaries were put in place, and an administrative structure was instituted to produce and distribute socially available resources. Now, it is therefore no wonder that nobody knows who owns what in these countries. It is amazing, a director, a theater director, movie director actually, whom you might know, Andrzej Wajda, who is very interested in the future of Polish theater, asked me some time ago, listen, could you find out who owns the theaters in Warsaw? Because we would like to save them, they're all failing, but we don't know what to do, we don't know how to take them over, it's not clear whom we should go to, who is the person who has any rights to them. And it's indeed unclear because many of these theaters are in a beautiful modern palace that is a sort of what is called Stalinist Gothic palace in the middle of Warsaw, which was a gift from the people of the Soviet Union to the people of Poland. And who are the people of Poland? The meaning of privatization is to institute for the first time in many years, genuine property relations. And because of the absence of the market, because nobody knows how much anything is worth, and you cannot know how much anything is worth because you take an enterprise, and no accounting method ever used will tell you what this thing is going to be worth in 2 years. Its assets on the books are completely unreliable because they're all done last year when the prices were regulated, and therefore you couldn't tell what the revenues were or what the expenditures were. Moreover, about 40% of the assets of most companies in Poland come from so-called inter-factory debt, which means that these factories served to each other as a banking system. They opened credit to each other and they sold on credit. And you would have to know the solvency of all the enterprises in the country to know what the value of the debt of the outstanding assets are. Also, if you want to know, I don't know what the price earnings ratio in Poland is, it's ridiculous that the companies are not bought and sold. If you want to know what they're going to be doing in 5 years, you either have to be God or Minister of Finance. Now, because of all these problems, in addition, as Mr. Bratinko mentioned, if you actually knew what they were worth and tried to sell them, you face the following problem. In Poland, actually, the whole state of the whole volume of savings, including under the mattress savings, is worth between 2 and 6% of the book value of Polish corporations. So if you want to sell them, if you never knew what the value was, nobody could buy them unless you discounted their price in such a way that it would be a giveaway anyway. And a very unjust form of giveaway, because the people who would have bought these things, would immediately, all the existing financial disparities, wealth disparities, would be magnified immediately the next day. And you have to remember that these existing differences in wealth are completely illegitimate. They're not perceived as legitimate by the people. They're viewed as the remnants of the old system. So privatization on the mode of, and it's a paradox in a way, to get where the Western countries are, you cannot follow them you cannot follow the models of privatization that have been worked out in the West. You have to find some new method of jumping ahead. You cannot have the state prepare the companies for privatization, because if the state knew how to run them, you wouldn't have to privatize. You cannot sell them because you don't know how much they're worth. You cannot sell them because you don't know to whom. And if you start selling them to foreigners at a very low, you have to discount it very much because of the insecurity. And that creates a lot of political problems immediately. People are beginning to scream that you are giving away the store to foreigners, and not without some justification. So privatization in Eastern Europe has to find some other methods. And it has to accomplish four objectives. First of all, it has to be quick, because the longer this state, the present state persists, the likelier an economic, total economic collapse in the future. Second, it has to be socially acceptable. That is, for example, one problem with reprivatization on a very large scale is that to give to an heir of somebody who 40 years ago lost some property is fine, so long as it doesn't turn out that there are 50, 1,000 people who suddenly receive gifts from heaven and who at the end of the process turn out to own the country. I think many people would have difficulties with viewing this kind of procedure as legitimate. Similarly, if you want to sell all of the assets to foreigners at discount prices, that from an economic point of view may make sense. However, this will be politically unacceptable. So you have to find a way in which, and moreover, privatization definitely is going to bring various hardships on. Namely, unemployment, as people restructure these companies, there's going to be unemployment and so on. And people have to be able to accept politically. So they must perceive the process as legitimate. Then the next problem is, many people have proposed, well, why don't we just give it away to everybody? To hold every citizen gets a voucher, let's give everybody a little share in our national economy. We always told people, it's yours. I mean, no, the communists told them it's yours. Let's just make good of it, and at the same time get rid of it very quickly. Well, it's a good start, but the problem is that if an average company has 100,000 shareholders, each of them holding one share, we haven't done very much. Because privatization is basically a system of management supervision. The state has to be replaced by somebody who can supervise the management so that the management and the workers don't really run the enterprise for their own benefit, which is the case in most, certainly in Poland and in Hungary. And so you have to have some ways of concentrating control. And the question is, how do you reconcile the concentration of control with widespread distribution of ownership? And that's, in some sense, technically the most difficult issue of privatization. And finally, you have to find a way in which foreigners can come in not as advisors, because it does no good to anybody. The Western capitalism was not built by advisors, but coming as businessmen, without at the same time doing what is politically unacceptable at this point, namely to make them own the country as a whole. So you have these four requirements, and the challenge for a privatization plan is to meet them all. I'm sorry, I overstepped a little bit my time.
Thank you very much. What we're going to do now is to allow 2 minutes to any of the speakers who wish to respond to anything that has been said heretofore, and at the end of that time we will open this up to questions using the mics that are distributed here between the various sections of the audience. Oh, by the way, in front of you are these mics. You have to press the button to turn it on. Who wishes to make a statement? Professor Epstein.
Is technology working?
Yes.
It is still? Great. I hope I don't spend 2 minutes. I wanted to talk a little bit about what Professor Rapachinsky said, because I think that what's happened is he's influenced too much by his ex-colleague Bruce Ackerman and not enough by the hard realities of the time. To spend your time worrying about an acceptable redistribution when fair distribution means starvation for everybody strikes me as being an idle quest. You have to worry at this point about maximization of aggregates and let the distribution take care of itself. I know it sounds bloodless, but the alternative is to say the following. We will insist upon doing something which is socially or politically acceptable. That will so constrain the available options to us that we will end up doing nothing at all. The way in which you have to play this game is to educate the politics and push hard against the grain if that's what it is. The moment you let sentiments of equity dominate in this particular situation, it's a dead loser. There are simply so many constraints that he's given that the set of feasible solutions that come out of it turn out to be zero. Now, the second thing that I think is wrong with that proposal is that it underestimates the power of an aftermarket. And there are two ways in which I think the mistake is made. One, with respect to the Western debt given by American banks to Polish and other Eastern European countries, with, of course, Western government guarantees. It's the savings and loan crisis is not the only place in which the guarantee has been misplaced. What you don't do is you don't forgive those debts, you renegotiate. You work out one way or another, just the way when you have bankrupt firms in a domestic situation, you just don't throw in 100% of the earnings. What you do is you try to figure out various kinds of extensions, debt equity swaps, or any one of another thing. The same thing can go with respect to the giveaway. I'm not so sure that a giveaway is not a bad idea. I don't much care who gets anything because I think the redistribution question is just wildly overblown. But what you want to do is to make sure that those shares are freely alienable. And tell anybody once you sell it and you take your consideration, it's over. Then you don't have to worry so much about the control blocks because they'll form naturally as they're building entrepreneurs. The third thing you have to do is you have to kill all forms of xenophobia. That is, the only way that you will survive in Eastern Europe is to get infusions of Western capital. And if you start to announce that you're welcome only on limited terms, it's not going to come. And if it comes, it's not going to stay. So it seems to me that this is a circumstance in which you don't have the luxury to have as much government as we do in the West. First, you've got to get yourself up on production, and that means that the right injunction was his first one, quick. And it's going to be very quick and very dirty. But when you mismanage something for 40 years, the thought that now you're going to follow all constraints of equity and getting yourself, most of which are misguided anyhow, and get yourself into some sort of promised land seems to me to be the recipe for disaster. So I'm going to call Rapachinsky back home and tell Bratinka to go it alone.
Professor Rapachinsky, he did agree that it should be quick.
Okay. I think that Professor Epstein is living in a world of dreams. The hard reality is that we already see what happened in Poland in the last election. And what happened is that a man from nowhere, a Martian, descended upon Poland. Yes, sir. And suddenly won 25% of the vote and may in a week become president. And God knows what this man stands for. The xenophobia in Eastern Europe, root out xenophobia. It's easier said than done. It can't be done. The only way in which it can be done is if the economy is set on the right footing. And I think we have a little bit of a vicious circles. But don't despair. The set of solutions is not zero. Here's one.
Okay. Despair, too long.
The problem, there also, debt renegotiation is a form of forgiveness, okay? And it has to be renegotiated right away. And the Western bankers should not believe that they're going to get more than 17 cents in a dollar. That control will come naturally. No, control will not come naturally. If you have an economy, if you're trying to privatize economy, if you're trying to privatize corporations that employ, say, 200,000 people, it will take a very long time for people to buy up shares to exercise control.
24 hours?
48.
Find those people who want to buy them.
Mr. Patinkin. Press.
This side thing.
You have to push the thing up to the top.
So,
you have to be as loud as
us. Only two notes. First, about the help. Czechoslovakia is owned, the Iraq owes to Czechoslovakia about $1 billion. That is 1/6 of our yearly exports. We have lost it by joining the world in cooperating against Iraq. So we really need some money. The second is about the problem of too wide distribution of ownership among people while you give away the state properties. I think we can reasonably count on the fact that about half of the population is not interested in any ownership or long-term ownership. They are going to sell the shares they are going to obtain. Second, we will or we wish that the foreign companies or foreign investors come to our country and buy shares. And there is a reasonable hope that although their ownership will not be the majority one, they will exert a lot of pressure on this company, a sort of a outside reasonable control. And I think there will be a political willingness to accept this control, because we know very well that it would be very sound influence.
Judge Kaczynski.
Can I have just a couple of words? I think the question of external debt is kind of a red herring. It's just like any other debt. The reason it'll be forgiven or renegotiated is not out of some act of generosity on our part. It's just because it's bad debt.
Thank you.
This is not a subsidy. This is just like the SNL crisis. You know, you face reality and you deal with reality that this debt was extended foolishly and will be repaid on the same basis.
Foolishly,
if at all. The second comment, the analogy keeps being made, and Professor Baczynski made it to the Marshall Plan. I've never been entirely convinced by that, and perhaps we can discuss it a little more. The fundamentally different situations. What you have here are malfunctioning economies, economies where people actually have jobs. They happen to be the wrong jobs. They actually have factories. They happen to be doing the wrong thing. They have a form of social organization. They have a economy of sorts. It just doesn't work. And what you have to do is wean them off that particular form of organization and into a different system. And there's no easy way of doing it that has ever been explained to me. You have to have transitional employment. You have to have those factories you're going to have to shut down because they're inefficient. You're going to have to reorganize the methods of agriculture. And those are painful processes. And what I kept hearing, and what worries me, and what I hear whenever I speak to many people from the Eastern Bloc economists, fortunately not all, but many, is we need is basically some sort of form of unemployment insurance, something to kind of feed our people while we're making this transition, as if we can take people from the communist system and kind of build a capitalist system over here, and then they can move in like into a new house. Just don't work that way.
Yeah.
All right. At this point, we are going to turn this over to the audience for, if you would line up behind the various microphones, those who wish to ask questions. What I would like you to do, if you would, was first identify yourself, and then if you have a particular speaker to whom you'd like to address your question, mention that. We'll give all speakers a chance to respond in addition to the one who is addressed. Gary.
Yes, I'm Gary Lawson from Northwestern Law School. Professor Rapuchinsky and Judge Kaczynski both spoke about some of the political and economic problems of a transition from a socialist regime to a private property regime. It strikes me that there's another dimension to that problem that I'd like to hear the panelists address. I'm wondering how well developed the private law regimes are in the Central and Eastern European nations and how that might affect the possibility of leaping to a property regime.
Professor Rabotinsky, why don't you start and we'll go right down the line here.
Well, insofar as the traditional forms of property, such as land ownership and various property ownership of various tangibles, that's not such an enormous problem. There's usually, in some of the countries at least, there is the old legal system that is easy to purge of the communist insertions. The problem is the one I mentioned before, and that means that the legal infrastructure of a developed market economy, things like company laws, security law, company law is woefully old-fashioned. For example, in Poland, you can do various kinds of things that are rather hair-raising. Similarly, you have to decide, for example, about such things as banking laws. Do you want to have banks that are universal banks, banks that exercise control over companies or not? These are not property rights in a very narrow sense, but they are the legal framework within which modern economy operates. And that is not only absent there, but nobody knows which one would be the best, and also nobody there knows what they don't know.
Judge Kaczynski, would you like to talk about Romania in this regard or add to that? All right.
Since I'm a detailed expert on all Eastern European countries, I will just say one thing. I suspect that the solution in many of these cases is not to wait to develop an internal situation. My advice would be to take every code, take FAPA company law. I would never take the American situation, of course, but say take the East German code and just simply say the code as it exists in such and such a date is the law here. And then I would remove from that all restrictions associated with mandatory terms. That is, I would say that the first law is unless otherwise agreed. And it seems to me that if you make that particular correction, you'll get things out. And this is exceedingly important because one of the things that has not been mentioned so far is the simple point, you don't need to have money to form a corporation. In Epstein's world, if you've got four people each making contributions of services, they could divide the shares in that company in any way that they see fit. And if they want to take back funny paper and stock in exchange for labor contributions, that's fine. And so what you want to do is to find that most pro freedom of contract oriented situation, because if you spend your time worrying about the distributional niceties, you're cooking. And in the United States, one of the things that we did when we tried to figure out what our legal history was as follows. We said in New York, the common law of England has existed on July 1st, 1776, is the law of New York. That's some kind of thing that could be done. Although, unfortunately, I would rather pick 1776 as my date if I were adopting American common law in Czechoslovakia than 1990.
Mr. Pertica.
Well, I have to admit that our commercial law is still at its very beginning.
UCC is pretty good.
It was practically destroyed by the companies because they don't needed it. Every disputes among companies were settled. Any disputes about companies were settled by the power apparatus, or there was a process of arbitrage where quite arbitrary decisions were made. And also, as far as I know, there is almost no law of tort. I mean, when...
count your blessings.
Well, but I think, although I know your problems with, for example, patients suing various doctors for damages, my country is on the other end of the extreme, or the pendulum swing too much to the other side. But we are now trying to do our best, and we know we need to fully develop commercial law nowadays.
All right, Roger.
Yes, Roger Pilon, Cato Institute. When I was in Bucharest in March, I saw one law professor at the law school there leafing through the commercial code from the 30s. It was the only copy in the library, and it was extremely out of date. It was something that has also been lost entirely in the historical memory of the people teaching there now. My question is for Professor Rapuschinsky, and I want to go back to your introductory remarks in response to Alex, which the remarks you said you hadn't intended to make. After listening to them, I can understand why. It seems to me that the two points I would make here, first of all, not on the debt issue, but on the Marshall Plan, it strikes me that there are a large number of people who say that Western Europe survived and prospered, notwithstanding the Marshall Plan, for the very reasons that Ed Meese cited earlier, namely that they simply did away with all the advice they were getting from the West and Western economists in particular, and simply freed up the market. But I think what Alex had in mind, in addition to the debt issue, was also the kind of aid that is coming from such organizations as the World Bank, the IMF, and of course they are lining up in Washington right now to send all that money over there in spades. The World Bank and IMF have had a history of perverse loans, of absolutely reckless government-to-government loans, which have created all the kinds of perverse incentives that not only do not help a market, but frustrate a market from coming up. A market will come up if a legal structure is in place. If we, on the other hand, try to pick and choose winning industries or winning governments, we're going to frustrate that natural process from ever coming about.
You agree?
Professor Rapins? I don't know where to begin. Now, it might very well be that the Marshall Plan killed off Western Europe. It's very nice to be among the group of people who love controversial statements. But I have recently been to Hungary, for example, and the whole privatization process in Hungary is now geared to getting money, to sucking out available capital from private individuals who can open small businesses and to pay it back to Citibank. Now, I think that some people in this room may think that this is a great idea and that this will really help Eastern Europe, and that will put Germany in a situation that will be advantageous as compared to Western Germany after the war. But it seems to me that to state this claim is to refute it.
Professor Epstein.
Yeah, I must say I am torn about the repatriation issue with respect to the past debt. I mean, I'm not quite sure what the optimal strategy is on renegotiation and so forth. And I think that all people can agree that on that transitional problem, that if you take a new enterprise, for example, in corporate reorganization today and subject to a lien, which is in excess of its market value, the new managers are essentially going to be in foreclosure before they start. So that there's a respectable side there. But I think the really important part of Roger's question is the other half of it. I think what the United States ought to do is forthwith announce it will never give another dime to the World Bank or the International Fund for Investment and Overseas. That is, once you have state-to-state loans, it turns out that the only way that your loan covenants will work is to make sure that the state agency will have some kind of a local monopoly so it could pay back the funds. And so what you do is you get foreign capital going in there to establish state-owned monopoly industries on the other side. And there is nothing more pernicious than that. And that's not a transitional issue where Rapuschinsky may well be right and the doubters like myself and Kaczynski may be wrong. That's just a sheer, outright, complete and total intellectual blunder. And it seems to me that on that point, we ought to be emphatic, even if on the other point, we admit perhaps the United States or the Western European countries ought to eat something on the guarantee in order to secure a workout. But, so on one thing, I'm going to be Catholic and open. And on the other thing, I'm going to be as nasty and as vicious as I could possibly be. If the State Department gets involved in this, or you hear Ms. Schwartz, then we can be sure it's going to be doomed. And don't forget it.
Any other of our speakers wish to comment? If not, we'll take the next question from the middle microphone.
I'm Lauren Homer. I'm in private practice in Washington, D.C., and I have a question that's a little bit off what you've been discussing, but there's another sector of these economies that is going to have to get back into private hands, and that's the charitable sector, church buildings, hospitals, orphanages, and, well, possibly not orphanages, but other organizations that in our country are run by private entities. And in most cases, the buildings and the properties have been severely damaged and deteriorated over time. And I wondered if, in your experience, you've come up with any ideas as to how these problems might be addressed. How do you get these things back into the private hands?
Professor Epstein.
Yeah, I've got a suggestion. I mean, one of the things is, for example, our temple has, you try to work buddy arrangements with other institutions. So you support people. And what you do is you go church to church and organization to organization, and you try to get American institutions on a privatized basis to go over there. And it seems to me that once it's clear that they could enter and leave, you will get some movement in that particular direction. And so I would simply say that religious organizations should find the natural affinities in a religious organization. But again, keep the state out of it, because we've managed to wreck our church and state relations, and there's no reason why they ought to do it today.
Mr. Patinkin.
I think this is a more problem of the people as such. If these organizations, the charitable institution and others, get enough people who are going to, who would work voluntarily, I think we will see a very speedy blossoming out of these things. I remember my, although officially scout was forbidden, my daughter was participating in an underground scout organization, and they were thriving. So I saw. And also, if you, of course, my country is in a mess. But if you walk through the regions which were which are outside of Prague, you see that, or you were seeing in the past, but nowadays it is less. On Saturdays and Sundays, on free days, all the villages were bustling with activities of people who were building their houses. So there is a tremendous potential in people's activities. And I think once this potential is tapped, you will see a small miracle again in Eastern Europe.
All right, let's turn to the questioner over here.
My name is Stuart Wald. I'm a student at Tulane Law School. I make no claims as to how to solve the overall economic inversion, but I spotted one thing in the discussion that might help clear some of the undergrowth. There was the problem both of debts owed by the Eastern European countries to the United States and the EC nations, and also the possibly lesser problem just brought up, for example, of Iraqi debts owed to Czechoslovakia. I believe Poland may have some also. Could there be a, if you could pardon the word, collectivization of debts, in which through debt negotiation, the debts owed to Eastern European countries are assigned to the West, who might have a better chance at collecting one way or another, in return for at some rate of exchange for the debts owed by the Eastern Europeans, and that might give them a fresh credit rating.
Okay. Do we have someone who wishes to address that? All right. Professor Epstein.
You go into a voluntary market right now and sell it. You don't have to do collectivization. Put it up for bid.
Yeah, but I think to follow on his question,
he wants a subsidy.
Suppose there's no bidders.
Then the answer is never use disguised subsidies. Because what happens is you start getting back into the mess. You think the debt's worth 20 cents on the dollar, and so what you do is you're paying 50, and nobody will know how much of a subsidy is or why it is. And I think generally it's what they say in poker. You want to make friends with somebody from whom you've taken money. Don't lose it at the table. Make a side transaction. Just give it back to them afterwards. Keep the two processes distinct. Don't muddy the waters.
Judge Kaczynski, are you raising your hand because you want to comment?
Well, or scratching I keep being troubled. You know, this external debt problem just seems to be such an overhang. You know, they could walk away from these debts tomorrow. It wouldn't be the end of the world. Argentina did. I mean, it's been done. And that really is a sideshow. How the external debt gets handled is a sideshow. The real show is how do you deal with a organization of the economy within the country. What you suggested is might work if you get a market for it. If not, it might not. But the external debt is our problem, yours and mine. It's not their problem.
Gene said that.
And the next question here.
My name is Bill Tett. I practice law in New Orleans and teach comparative law at Loyola University. And I'd like to address this question to Mr. Patinkin. It's about a matter that seems like we have a little bit of similarity in Louisiana with Czechoslovakia. We have in Louisiana some land that was expropriated by the state years ago called the Bohemia Spillway. And the legislature, in its infinite wisdom, decided to give it back to the heirs and decreed that be done. That was a couple of years ago. The problem is there's no mechanism for doing it really effective, and everybody's claiming to be an heir. And the result has been, well, the land previously was in commerce and productive in the sense that though it wasn't used to build a spillway to protect New Orleans, it was valuable oil-producing land, and there were mineral leases that were being given to private oil companies which could go in and exploit for oil. But now that the privatization has been adopted without a mechanism, effective mechanism, rapidly to get the land back into commerce, there's no leases being let and drilling's being held back. So I'd like to ask what kind of mechanism do you see for privatizing, getting back to the original heirs? How do you keep the land in commerce at the time, and what would be wrong with the alternative of letting people bid on it for a share of the profits to come, and then if the government wants to compensate the former owners, to go ahead and compensate them monetarily rather than in kind?
Right.
I cannot give you a ready answer because there is now a fierce discussion in Czechoslovakia. In fact, there are going to be two completely different laws being submitted to the parliament how to solve the problem. As I told you, technically, farmers never cease to be the owners of the land which was collectivized. But the thing developed that a collective farm was hiring other workers who have been working there for 30 years without owning a piece, while many original owners moved to the city. And now there is a danger that, first of all, the workers who didn't own anything will claim their share, if they are already doing that. And on the other hand, the people who just, well, in fact, practically said goodbye to their ownership will come back and claim it back. So there is no ready solution. And also some of the land is destroyed because there are buildings on it. There is no small machinery geared to the smaller lots than those huge, almost endless collective farm plots, etc. It is a problem to which I cannot give you any answer.
But there is.
Yes, Alex?
Well, you know, you point out a very important issue, and that is that you've got to have, whatever the rule is in resolving these conflicting interests, it's got to be simple, it's got to be clear, even if you lop off a few fingers. Let me offer a rule, and this is, I've thought about it a little bit, I'm not sure it's perfect, but if it's a life in being, if it's property that was owned by somebody who's still alive, even if it was collected by 70 years ago, and they can prove the ownership by some objective means, then they have priority. If a person is dead, anything within the last 10 years, anything collective, anything nationalized within the last 10 years, where you have a conflict between current users and past title owner, the current user gets it and the title owner gets monetized. Simple as that. Will it always work? No, it's a simple rule. It makes sure the people who are actually on the property now using it and who have somehow gotten vested rights to it will not be displaced, and it also assures the equity rights of the prior title holder. But the kind of complication that our legal system creates when we get a problem like that is surely to be avoided.
Professor Epstein.
Yeah, I agree with Alex, and I want to take it one step further, which is that in general, the last thing you want is to have unintended joint tenancies with respect to small parcels of land. You don't want six people all having a 1/6 interest in anything, because then you have modest little piece of socialism. Whenever I teach property and I teach joint tenancy, I said, if you think socialism could work, watch when four siblings squat over some cottage. You will discover that it doesn't do very well. I think the other thing is, in addition to monetization, is a following rule. Is that you allow unilaterally, without cause, without justification, without explanation, anybody who has a joint ownership interest to force a public auction and a sale immediately, so that one guy could put it up for sale, and that way we'll get it back into the stream of commerce. And the strategy is identical in some sense to Alex's, because that means that what you're saying to people is you don't own land, you own an interest in a fund, and you're basically, through the market and a resale market, monetizing the interest. If you have joint ownership of productive assets, it's going to be a dead loss. There may be the occasional loss of equity, but it's small price to pay for getting the stuff back into the stream of commerce.
Incidentally, you've come up with a solution that Napoleon adopted about joint ownership, which we adopted in Louisiana.
Yes.
Professor Epstein, did you have a comment on that?
No.
If not, we'll go to the last question here.
My name is Karen Tiffany. I'm from Washington, D.C., and more or less retired. I have to suggest three models from our past that may, that might offer some dynamic for use, and ask your comment. The preparatory remark would be that to maximize the freedom of the participants involved to work out some deal, and if you don't have a law infrastructure to back that up, you'll leave that for later, and if you get disputes, then have somebody to work it out somehow. But the first model would be the, as in the Oklahoma land rush, somebody was, one of you mentioned, you're not sure you would object if you give the land who has ever happened to be standing on it. Well, there was a slightly more organized thing in our past. I don't know if our visitors from abroad know about it, but they had a starting line, and then they all rushed to the land they wanted, and what they found, they got. And they had some set of rules, but minimal. One model. Another model would be employee stock ownership plan. Which is a way of moving towards ownership by the workers in an industry. Now, there are all kinds of reasons why it might not fit, but if the dynamic, some sort of a stakeholding structure to hold the capital while the employees could work their way to owning it. That's very loosely stated, a second model. A third model is what we have seen over the post-World War II years with American and probably European investment in third world countries, where the country needed the foreign investment. They were prepared to have it. They're prepared to offer incentives, and yet xenophobia and otherwise, they wanted to keep control. So agreements worked out where the local ownership, very often a somewhat dictatorial government, would retain a measure of control, and the foreign corporation would have that measure of control which it needed for to become for it a profitable enterprise. And the well, you worked the enterprise into a free market enterprise, even though you had a residuum of governmental control.
All right, who would like to comment on any of these three models? Professor Reprezinski?
I want anticipatorily to agree with Professor Epstein.
Thank you.
And that is about one thing at least. These ESOPs are a terrible idea for Eastern Europe. The reason why this is...
You're talking about the third model?
No, that's the second model.
The second model.
The third one's bad, too.
The second model I'm talking because of the following problem. One of the most important... In Poland, for example, the structure of central control over industry has been basically abolished. What does this mean? The manager is nominally in control. There's, however, one constituency that he has to satisfy, and that's his workers' council. In fact, the Workers' Council at this moment is ruling the enterprise very commonly. And what do they care about? They care about maintaining employment and not lowering at least salaries as production is falling down. Now, we have an extremely interesting fact where production in Poland fell something like between 30 and 40% within the last year. And layoffs have been practically non-existent. There is statistical unemployment, which is mostly because of an unemployment policy that unemployment compensation policy that the government has been following. But there have been something like 100,000 people who've been laid off work in a country of 30 million where production fell between 30 and 40%. Now, obviously, restructuring means very large
unemployment, general unemployment. And then you can deal with it socially the way you want. That is, if you want to open public works or you want to do something in order to have some peace. But here, again, I think I agree with Professor Epstein, you don't mix the two. You don't subsidize the particular enterprises. Let them shed labor, then you do with the unemployment whatever you want. But the worst thing would be to have these workers decide who is going to be fired, because the answer is nobody, until the enterprises run to the ground.
I disagree with Professor Rapachinsky in one regard. I'm not sure whether your second alternative is worse than your third or your third is worse than your second. That is the last, I mean, it's a tough battle. That is, the model of joint foreign and domestic ownership, of course, is the Union Carbide plant, which went up at Bhopal. And what it has is they kept 51%, you were supposed to operate it. Then by a combination of regulatory change and stock ownership, they threw out Union Carbide, ran the plot themselves, had an Indian saboteur blow up the pave, and then were forced to pay several billion dollars, or hundred millions of dollars in damages. You don't want state-owned enterprises. And this is a classic illustration of doing something badly by insisting that transitions have to be slow. I'm a cold turkey guy, and I want that turkey to be frozen, because I think it's the only way they will start off straight. And what you're doing is you're trying to ease the pain. And what you're doing is you're just, it's the easing the pain in the same way that somebody says when you slash your wrists, the way in which you ease the pain is to keep them under warm water. And I don't think that's a very good idea at all. And the first one I think is irrelevant, because the Sooners, in effect, they cheated. That's why they were called Sooners. And we're not dealing with vacant land. What we're dealing with is with capital structure fundamental mismanagement. So I think Pearson and Post and the Wild Foxes are a very interesting problem, but they're not the one that you face now. It's bankruptcy and reorganization is your metaphor, not the fox on the moor.
I can't help but put in a comment that the idea of a phased transition is a little bit, has been likened by other people to the case of if the United Kingdom decided to change from driving on the left-hand side of the road to driving on the right side of the road, phase by phase, trucks one year, buses the next year, and cars the next, it would indeed be chaos. Let me read one announcement that is important to some of you, and that is that any lawyers who are present who wish to earn CLE, continuing legal education credit in Louisiana, must sign in for every panel, each one of these. There is a sign-up sheet just outside the doors, along with copies of written remarks required by the Louisiana Bar Association. If there are any questions, ask Debbie or Darlene, who will be there to help you. Any of you who are not licensed to practice in Louisiana and wish to sign up for the Louisiana Bar, I'm sure they'll take your applications as well.
Another piece of regulation which you would do well not to emulate in Eastern Europe.
In summary, let me thank our panelists. I think Mr. Pertica certainly gave us an excellent start by indicating the challenges that this transition will meet in his country and inferentially in the other countries as well. Professor Epstein, I think, gave a dramatic example of what not to do in making these changes. Judge Kaczynski. Judge Kaczynski certainly gave some practical advice in terms of not letting the political system get in the way of sound economic practices, and also the problems that we would encounter if indeed there was a widespread underwriting of the new economic systems. And I think there was, in discussion, there was considerable concern expressed about underwriting either ourselves or letting some of the international monetary type organizations into it. Professor Rapachinsky, voicing some disagreement with that concept, indicated that there needs to be some way in which we can provide assistance. He indicated the importance, the seriousness and the differences in the problems of privatization in these countries, where they don't have the infrastructure that has been present in other countries that have been more successful in this regard, and indicated the necessity of socially and politically acceptable solutions. I think if we had to draw one thing out of at least a majority of the conversation, including the questions, it would be that when we talk about property rights, and it is important that there be a system of property rights, that it should be a system of private property, and to the absolute extent possible, far beyond anything what we have done in our country, that we keep the government out of it. And with that bit of advice, I thank you all for being here. I thank our panelists, and I particularly appreciate, Mr. Pertica, your being with us and presenting your views. Thank you.